Nexus PMG welcomes you to the Bigger Than Us podcast, which we as energy geeks lovingly refer to as the BTU. Bigger Than Us is a podcast that focuses on ideas that will shape the future of our planet and ultimately our existence. We will occasionally lean into energy topics because, after all, it's the key to our collective survival, but we'll also explore other ideas and topics that we believe will have an impact that is bigger than us. And now, on to today's show. Hello and welcome to the Bigger Than Us podcast. I'm your host, Raj Daniels, and today I'd like to welcome back to the show, Josh Kaufman. Josh Kaufman is currently the president of Nexus Development Capital, a platform investing development capital in renewable and circular economy projects. Previously, he was an energy investor at the Australian fund QIC, and prior to that, was in the GE Power M&A team. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you, Raj?
Josh, I'm doing very well, thank you. Josh, before we dig into Nexus DevCap, I want to kind of tee off on the conversation we had in our last interview 3 years ago, February 2021. We were talking about wealth distribution and some of the challenges around it. And I know it's a big, broad, overarching problem slash issue, but where do you think we are, you know, post-pandemic now from a wealth distribution standpoint? Let's talk specifically in the US. How do you think things are looking today?
Interesting. I think when I made that comment, there's two different sides to it. In the US, we split between liberal and conservative. And when I say wealth distribution is the biggest problem, it also means that each side defines it differently. Liberals would say that there's too much wealth concentrated at the top. And conservatives would say the top provides a lot of economic drivers and are bearing an unfair share of the tax burden and other burden. And so it depends on your perspective on if we're actually in a better or worse position. I said that was the key problem because aligning those two views, it's hard to get anything done if those two views aren't aligned. I mean, which way should we move? We're kind of in deadlock. And there was a quote by Abe Lincoln, and I can't recall if I'm going to get this exactly correct. It was along the lines of every society has one core issue. It's to prevent some men from saying to many men, you make bread and I will eat it. And I think that's really the main issue is we can't even agree on who's actually making the bread and who's eating it. So in a very political way, I'll abstain from saying, are we better or worse? Because I think that really depends on what.
It's an interesting, you know, during MBA school, the correct answer to every question was, and I guess to some extent is, it depends.
Right. And my dad's an economist, and there's the Reagan quote about a one-handed economist. So I guess I learned well.
You know, I pulled some data before the conversation, and again, can't believe everything you read, but it says that middle class saw their share of wealth decline. Top 0.1% saw their wealth increase. So it's been, and again, who knows where the data is coming from, right? What the sources are. But from this data in particular, it shows like we are not moving in a direction that for some, it will not be advantageous to the economy in whole over time if this continues to play out the way it is.
Yeah, I personally agree with that.
So I guess we can try to solve this issue in a later conversation offline. But let's jump back to DevCap. Launched DevCap in 2021, I believe, when we had our first conversation. We are 3 years into the journey. What have you learned? What have you seen? How's the landscape changed?
Yeah, well, let me start with the latter point first. There are a number of other groups like us trying to solve the same problem, and that's very encouraging. We don't view them as competition. A lot of these problems need a lot of help, and it's encouraging to feel like we're on to something. So there's more talk around what we're doing, which is providing early stage infrastructure development capital. In some instances, you could call it catalytic or first of a kind capital. And it's good to see other people joining. Well, we've learned a lot, for sure. And the main issue is just, how do you make this a profitable business model? The opportunity's been there for a lot of investment firms to see. It just hadn't made sense for various types of traditional forms of capital to invest in for various reasons that we can talk about later. So along the way, we're trying to create arguably a new flavor of capital to invest in things. And inherently, we're going to have learnings about what works and what doesn't work along the way, both in terms of how do we set up our deals, what types of groups do we want to invest into, how do we run our diligence process internally, how big do we want to be, those types of things.
So you mentioned there are more players in the field. I'm going to say, to some extent, Nexus DevCap was the leader or tip of the spear. What do you think encouraged these new players to enter?
Yeah, I think what a lot of people see the issue that we see, which is the world is getting warmer. We need to figure out ways to reduce carbon emissions. That's going to require trillions of dollars of infrastructure. We're not building that infrastructure fast enough. And how do we unlock more infrastructure that helps with carbon reduction and emission reduction? So that's a problem that a lot of people see. And the question is, where do we fit in the life cycle of that problem, essentially? And how can we create a business model that actually works? So I think it just follows the flows of it. I believe that these dollars moving into climate-friendly sectors are just continuing to increase. Even though ESG currently has a bad rap, I think that's a little bit more to do with the S and the G part. The environmental infrastructure dollars continue to grow, and this problem just needs to be solved.
If I remember correctly, the space that Nexus DevCap plays in is a, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a higher risk, higher reward sector. Is that correct?
Yeah. So let me expand on that. So unfortunately, the types of deals we invest in have almost all the bad aspects of what one looks for when you invest in something. And so historically, if you think about what makes a good investment, it's got positive cash flow, or if it doesn't have cash flow, at least it has positive revenue. It's got some downside projection for your investment, like collateral. It's got proven management teams, groups that have done this before. It's got minimal binary risks that could turn things sideways. It's got really significant growth prospects, so that if you invest and you've got a lot of capital appreciation, you can win big. It's got defensible moats, so you have competitive advantages against other groups. It might need, hopefully, not much capital in the future, because future capital just means dilution to early investors, or it could just mean reduced dividends to existing investors. Those are a lot of things that make a good investment. And when we're investing in a team that's developing infrastructure, they often have none of those. And so, you know, traditional investment schools of thought would say it's just not a good investment. So now how do we decide that we can invest? And let me take an interim step. The venture capital community over the past couple of decades learned that they could sacrifice the first half of the things I mentioned as long as they really held to the second half. And so if we go through those again, the earlier ones like positive cash flow or revenue and downside protection and management teams, a lot of venture targets don't have that. They're inventing technology. They might be very young founders who haven't done it before. There's nothing really there to prevent capital loss. But a lot of the time, if there's a ton of growth prospects and there's minimal CapEx required in the future, the gains can be huge. And that's where the venture model really focused on the software world, really specifically because of that last requirement that you can minimize future CapEx. So what the venture model learned is you don't need to get everything right. You're going to take a lot more risks because the first half is going to be wrong. But your winners can really outweigh your losses. So you can get one right, two right in a fund, and that could make the entire fund. But the issue with what we do is because things require so much capital in the future to get stuff built, it's hard to get 20x returns, 100x returns. And so to your point about higher risk, higher return, unfortunately, you could argue that we're taking pretty high risk and the return isn't quite as high, or at least it's not high enough for the venture model. And so then you say, well, how do we, well, what makes this a good risk adjusted risk return? And our approach is that we are trying to, given that the returns are lower than traditional venture returns, we need to invest in things that are slightly lower risk, even though they are risky compared to traditional investment metrics. And so why do we think we can do that? Well, we think that because the prospects for all of these technologies continue to get better because of increased demand for environmentally friendly products, many of which is regulatory driven, some of which is customer driven. Number two, because what I mentioned before, there's hundreds of billions of dollars that wants to invest in climate infrastructure and just can't. It's one of the largest buyer universes ever for the essentially the companies and the products that we're developing to sell into. And number three, we do think the risks are misunderstood in project development, which we can talk a little bit about. It is viewed by many in the community as just something that they can't touch and they won't do. But once you get into what it takes to develop a good project, I think we think we can understand those risks a bit more, and it's not quite as risky. So I don't know where to put us on the very traditional risk return spectrum. And that's kind of historically been the issue with groups that need this type of money.
So I've been around the venture community for about 10 to 12 years. And one observation that I've had is that depending on the venture fund, they have a really robust ecosystem to where they can take a company slash product and they can promote that product within that ecosystem, influencing the buyers, if you will, to test, try, purchase a particular product from their portfolio. Can you talk about the Nexus DevCap ecosystem and how perhaps that might be a competitive advantage?
For sure. Yeah, and it's a different skill set and value prop, but I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, there is a number of investors out there who they'll provide money, or sometimes they'll provide money and connections. I'd say that's the vast majority fall into that category. As you're saying, sometimes there's an ecosystem of what else do you provide. Our version of the ecosystem is we have to help develop these projects and scale these companies, because these are generally groups of either 2 to 10 people who are trying to do something new, and it's mechanical processes. So you've got engineering understanding that you need. You have to have commercial understanding with what type of feedstock you're using in your process and your offtake agreements or your revenue structure and your legal contracts. And you have to be able to build partnerships. You have to have the financial wherewithal to navigate the different capital markets. So it's incredibly complicated what these groups are trying to do. And we never find ourselves just being an investor and disappearing. So our version of that ecosystem is we have to plug in and help those developers, because none of them are really staffed to do it all because they're capital constrained. So we have to help either on the engineering side or either on the commercial side or on the financial side or on the leadership side. And we find ourselves plugging into various different parts of each different company.
So you mentioned project development risk being misunderstood, I believe. Can you give me an example of some of the misunderstandings?
Yeah, I think it is a super complex problem. Like, how do you build these new types of infrastructure? But there's a lot of recurring themes. Are they using proven technology? Did they follow the proper steps in their design and their site selection? Do they have buyers for their product? Do they have the right team to execute? Are their material permits outstanding? And so, you know, you kind of go through these checklists of things, and qu- quite often you find a lot of the teams are just are missing something in the pretty standard checklist. So we think we've got a pretty decent understanding of those processes, and we've got a lot of various capabilities, both within Nexus Development Capital, our company, and then the partner, which is Nexus PMG. There's a ton of engineers and project developers over there who have been doing this across all sorts of technologies. And so we quite often find when we're analyzing projects and we are able to tap into all of our expertise, also after seeing at this point over 400 different projects through this lens, that we've just seen so many of these recurring themes and that we're able to help with a good chunk of them as well.
So from a technology perspective, where on the technology readiness level is your sweet spot?
Yeah. So we like to say that we are TRL 7 and above, which means that there's a lot of data that you can show that something works. We are willing to take some scale-up risk. If we can get our heads around the scale-up, that generally means certainly you're doing less than 10 times scale-up, ideally much less. But we need to see some operating data. We're not looking to invest in a team with a concept, something proven at a bench scale that could be super disruptive. And part of that is because we, our buyer universe, the groups that are going to fund the subsequent projects, are infrastructure investors who are looking for proven technologies, stuff with thousands of hours of runtime, ideally insurance packages or companies with balance sheets that can provide guarantees on the equipment. And so we're actually not looking to necessarily create something disruptive. We're looking to create a bundled package that looks as much like a fixed income product as you can. So that's where we end up at TRL 7. Now, because of my earlier comment that there just aren't that many groups like us, and generally the people who write small checks tend to be venture investors who inherently want differentiated technology because that's what leads them to their outsized returns. What we find is that, in my opinion, the capital markets have driven most people who are looking for small dollars to create something new. Sometimes groups don't even actually have something new, but they've learned that they have to put their pitch decks in such a format that it looks like they've got something new. So we find ourselves often really flirting with that TRL 7 line. We would love to do TRL 9 stuff. There just aren't that many developers out there who are just purely developing TRL 9 projects.
You mentioned an insurance package. Can you expand on that?
I can try. It's not my area of expertise. There's a number of groups out there, and I think more coming, who see the same gap. We're both trying to solve the same problem of how do we get this type of infrastructure built. And they also see that the community of infrastructure investors, project finance investors, and lenders need certainty of cash flows. And insurance is historically a way to provide certainty over cash flows. So different groups are trying to insure things that hadn't always previously been insured. Historically, an EPC firm could guarantee the construction of a facility, and an equipment manufacturer could guarantee the functioning of their equipment. Sometimes insurance will fill the gaps and guarantee that the entire facility works, or they might come in on the revenue side and insure a floor price for a certain product that doesn't have a liquid market, or they might be able to insure a consistency of a feedstock that has some variability in it. So they're approaching it in a way to try and create consistency where there's historically hasn't been consistency for the same goal that we have to create projects that are ready for those hundreds of billions of dollars that want to do climate infrastructure.
I appreciate you sharing that. And I'm just thinking about what their due diligence process must look like, especially not having a lot of comparables to go along from a historical standpoint. Must be an interesting wager for them.
Definitely. And it depends on the product. So we've seen sometimes that the way they'll underwrite their own downside is they'll say, well, this technology might not be as great as you think, but maybe it can be reformed to do something slightly less valuable. In the case of the hydrogen ferry that we're invested in, insurance can look at that and say, what does it take to retrofit the hydrogen drivetrain power source with a more traditional diesel power source? And now you've just got a diesel ferry, and there's a market for what diesel ferries cost, and they know that's their downside case. In our investment where we were taking recycled motor oil and upgrading it to low sulfur diesel, there's intermediate products. You might not create a finished product from that process. You might create a blend stock for a refinery. That's very proven. You know what that costs. So insurance can take a view on what that might look like. So to your point, there's not that much data for the high-end use cases of what we're doing. And so sometimes they'll look at the low-end use cases and consider that the downside.
I appreciate that. Let's go back to the fund. When we last spoke, it was a $20 million fund. Now it's a $50 million fund. Is that inclusive of the 20 or an additional 50?
It's inclusive of the 20, and it was a lesson that we had when we set out. We purposefully did 20 because we purposefully did not want to be too big. Because when we started, the target deal was going to be about 2 to 3 million. And the thesis was there's a lot of teams out there that just need 2 to 3 million to unlock them for the next phase. And we found out that was just frankly too small. The three main criteria that we were looking for was, number one, a great management team. Even if they're not proven in this thing that they're doing, you know, we think they're very capable. Number two, doing TRL 7 and above projects. And number three, needed 2 or 3 million. That Venn diagram was extremely small. We found that groups that had great management teams and needed 2 to 3 million often were less than TRL 7. It was more of a venture process. There were groups that were looking to develop TRL 9 projects and needed 2 to 3. But we found that many of the good ones could often raise money through family and friends or were successful in other ventures and put some of their own money towards that amount and didn't need our capital. And then that left us with the third part of the Venn diagram that we could flex is there were a number of good teams that were developing TRL 7 and above technologies, but 2 million just didn't really get much. We found that really we needed to be in the $5 to $10 million range to help those teams. And so that's why we increased our commitment from 20 to 50.
So when you went back to the investor to ask for the additional capital, what kind of questions did the investor ask?
Basically laid out that narrative. They've been very supportive in understanding that we're trying to do something relatively new here, and those learnings resonated with them. And we just walked them through our journey of what we've learned, what we didn't learn, where we think there's upside, where we think there's more downside, and they supported us.
Now, you mentioned something earlier regarding ESG has been getting a bad rap recently, more the S and the G versus the E. What have you seen in the investor community, specifically dialogue around ESG?
Yeah, so I said that because a lot of the historical ESG funds, when you look at what they were actually investing into, it were S&G funds. You had oil majors in some of these S&G funds. You had a lot of tech funds because they had really strong governance policies. So a lot of the ESG money actually ended up going towards companies that excelled on the S and the G. Now there's a little bit of a backlash and there's pullback. So I think ESG as a term is complex because it's combining some really different trends. In terms of just pure climate, I personally just haven't seen any pullback in the amount of infrastructure dollars that wants to do pure climate. I am admittedly really just focused on the private markets. You know, some of this stuff is happening in some of the public markets, in SPACs and funds. I'm talking about the private infrastructure dollars raised because those are the target sellers for our projects. There just hasn't really been any pullback in terms of the amount of infrastructure dollars that wants to invest in climate-friendly infrastructure.
So from the private perspective, how did the passing or did the passing of the IRA influence additional investment dollars?
So from firsthand experience, I can say that the passing was massive in terms of interest and investments in certain sectors. Hydrogen was a good example. There became a ton of interest in hydrogen. It pared back a little bit when some of the hydrogen clarifications came out. Some of the tangential things that we've seen also is some of the grants that were passed in some of these programs. the Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations recently just announced some of their winners or their $6 billion worth of grants, a lot of which were industrial decarbonization, which is a sector that we focus in. So it was certainly catalytic in a lot of the sectors that we look at.
Now, back to the Nexus DevCap, 3 years into the journey, what have you learned about yourself?
Yeah, it's a great question. What have I learned about myself? So that's a good one. Let me start with the journey just purely on the professional side. You know, some things that are my strengths is I've got pretty high analytical capabilities. The reason that this journey was attractive to me, part of which is it's just a really complicated, hard puzzle to solve. There's just a lot of unknowns, a lot of moving pieces, and putting all that together. I love doing that analysis. I love the problem solving. Pretty good at finding the right resources to help. What I've learned I'm not so good at is my rote memory seems to be declining. That might just be related to the number of things to keep in mind. But when you're looking at all of these deals and all of these processes and all of these technologies and all of these regulations, you start to forget stuff. So I've learned I'm leaning a lot more on electronic tools to remind myself. Candidly, it's also my first time being an official leader, been a manager in the past, but never kind of started something, and explaining the vision of it and being very articulate in that and motivating people and inspiring people hasn't historically been my strong suit. That's something I've learned about myself.
So I know the team has increased since we last spoke. What techniques, tactics are you using to motivate the team?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just really don't like the term motivate, to be honest. And maybe that's part of the problem because I feel like it's a bit, in a sense, manipulative. I think what we're doing is so interesting. And I know there's a group of people out there who are interested in what we're doing. And I think it should be kind of self-motivating. I think from just a pure work perspective, I think what we're doing is an interesting enough problem. So that you should kind of want to do it. So I suppose what I tend to focus on is just making the team feel like people. In my past, I've worked at places where you start to just feel like a number. You kind of just realize you're a cog in the machine. I feel that's super demotivating. Work takes up so much of our lives that it shouldn't feel like something where you just have to come and your brain turns off and you're a machine for 8 hours or 12 hours or however many hours a day you're working. You're also a person during that time. And I really just focus on that. You know, even within that specifically, something I always found interesting in terms of leadership styles was people rarely tell their bosses the full truth. You know, people always want to show a somewhat rosy picture or sometimes feel uncomfortable telling their superiors something because they feel somewhat judged. And there's so much knowledge at companies in the employee base that I feel like goes untapped because of that dynamic. And so I'm pretty adamant about just trying to make people feel as comfortable as possible, insisting, always being open-minded to feedback, understanding that the feedback I receive is probably just a portion of the feedback that they want to give, and just making sure that people feel like people, they can affect change, they feel comfortable in the environment.
So it sounds like you're, and I'm maybe putting words in your mouth, it sounds like you're quite self-aware. Is that based on history, as you mentioned, other places you've worked, or is that work that you've done on yourself?
Both, for sure. Yeah, I think one nice thing about GE, if I were to use that as an example, that's where I started my career, is it was a rotational program and you would change jobs every 6 months. And it was a great training program, sometimes because of the official training that they would give you. But frankly, in my opinion, more because you just saw so many different leadership models and you met so many different people. You saw what worked. You saw what didn't work. You saw how bosses operated to their bosses. You saw how employees reacted to different situations. So there was just so much exposure to different models that was helpful. And then I'm also just a firm believer in self-work, going to therapy, meditating. I just think that's incredibly valuable.
Well, I second both of those. Now, last question, and I'm going to make it specific for Nexus DevCap. If we have people, companies in the audience that are looking for the kind of financing that DevCap provides, prior to making a submission, what are perhaps one or two inside baseball ideas or thoughts you could share with them?
Yeah, definitely. And first, I'll make a side note that as part of our $50 million raise, we actually expanded our name and not just our assets under management to go from Nexus DevCap to Nexus Development Capital, but just for the reference.
Well, that was a good use of some of the money.
That's right. The inside baseball, the number one thing we come across is the technology fully de-risked. And we'll just ask for what is the operating data on what exactly you're trying to do. And sometimes people say it worked in a certain environment and we expect this environment to be similar. It might have worked at that scale and we expect it to work at this scale. It worked creating that product and we expect it will create this product. And we just want to see the data that gets us comfortable with whatever you're trying to do. That's far and away the number one. Number two is your execution plan. And this stuff can be incredibly hard, and we've never seen an execution plan that has been thorough enough, and that's okay because we understand that this is all new. But trying to get your execution plan as thorough as possible, we love a good Gantt chart. And number three would be the quality of the team. So when we're interviewing people, we'll do reference checks, and we'll do background checks, and we get an understanding to the self-awareness point. Do you understand what you know, and do you understand what you don't know? Because nobody knows everything, and the teams that are acknowledging that they don't know everything and actually proactively seek the help versus the teams that get defensive. And if you start asking questions, they really defend their existing plan. That's essentially a non-starter.
Well, I appreciate those tips, Josh. It's been great catching up with you again, and I look forward to seeing what Nexus Development Capital does next.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Raj.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review on iTunes. And you can show your support by sharing our show with a friend or reach out to us on social media, where you'll find us under our Nexus PMG handle. If there's a subject or topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email, btu@nexuspmg.com, or contact me via our website, nexuspmg.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter where we share what we're reading and thinking about in the clean tech, green tech sectors. Bigger Than Us is a Nexus PMG production.